Now, the first thing I'd want to say is that history is contended. It's always contended. And it's hugely contentious. Now, one of the difficulties with history is that history is mediated. There is no possibility of encountering history except through some mediated form. Let me give you a simple illustration. Even your own personal history is mediated. You can't access your own personal history except through your own memories. And as we know, memories can be very fluid, and they can change and they can become modified as time goes by. And so history in general is hugely contentious. And I recognize that this particular subject tonight will be contentious. And so if I take a different position to a position that you're expecting, I hope that you will recognize that actually different positions can be taken, and you must judge whether or not the argument I've built has sufficient evidence to warrant what I would say about it. That's okay. The second thing I want to say, and this is more of an academic writer, if you like. I think it's important for me to state at the beginning, although I will try to present this as an academic, as somebody who's looked at this and tried to approach it in a detached way, I'm conscious of the fact that I come from a unionist tradition. And so, as much as I've tried to be objective, as much as I have tried to be scholarly in this, one accusation that someone might make of my presentation is that it reflects my unionist background and political tradition. And so that I issue as a kind of caveat to the presentation tonight, and I'm aware of the implications related to that. So let's begin by a brief introduction of the battle. What surprised me at the pastor's conference this week, I made what I thought was just wasn't a throwaway comment, but I thought it might engender a little interest, and I said, I'll touch on something that has relevance that links the Battle of the Somme and the Easter Rising. What I wasn't expecting were the number of pastors who came over and said to me, tell me more. The Battle of the Somme is linked to the Easter Rising via this place. Verdun. If you want to understand the Battle of the Somme, you have to understand a battle that was raging at Verdun. So the Somme is here. The Somme River runs through here. So this is the Somme battlefield. But this is the main area of interest. And the reason why that is that the German Chief of Staff, Falkenhayn, decided to bleed France dry. The intention was to knock France out of the war by literally grinding France in some kind of meat grinder. France had a series of fortified hills around Verdun, and the objective was to systematically smash away and literally bleed France dry. And it became one of the worst, most bloodiest battles in history. Casualty rates somewhere between 700,000 and 1 million in the Battle of Verdun. There was a very real possibility that France would be knocked out of the war. So the Battle of the Somme was actually designed and implemented to ease pressure on the French in Verdun. Because if the French had collapsed and morale was low, France was wobbling really, really badly, then the war would be lost. Britain would not have been strong enough to have fought Germany by herself at that time, and America is nowhere on the horizon. You may think, thinking of this in the 21st century, that that is an appalling thing to do. But actually, it's a well-known and well-established military tactic. When I was a brigade chaplain in Helmand in 2009, the brigade headquarters at Lashkar Gah was under immediate threat by a large enemy force. And we were expecting to be attacked by a huge enemy force. We knew, not just from intelligence reports, that this large force had gathered and were waiting to strike. They had taken out three outposts that acted as a kind of buffer around the brigade headquarters. They were Afghan National Police and Afghan Army, and they had overrun them and killed everybody inside it. And so in order to protect the city of Laskagar, what the British did is they got the first punch in. And so they attacked the enemy in a completely different location. American Special Forces landed in a place called Marja and created merry hell, actually. To such an extent that the enemy withdrew its forces from Laskagar to reinforce other areas. And that's what happens in Verdun. The attack on the Somme, disastrous as it was on the first day, actually is reasonably successful by the end of the battle. Not in in terms that we might think of successful, but in terms of the trench warfare that the First World War had become by this stage. It actually was reasonably successful. It also proved the training ground in which new tactics were developed that would ultimately lead to success in the First World War. And so because the attack was so sustained, the Germans were expecting something. What they were not expecting was an attack of that sophistication and intensity. And that draws forces from Verdun up to reinforce the German lines around the Somme, easing pressure on Verdun. The French survive, remain in the war, and you know the rest of the history. That's a map in relation to the Somme. So up at the top you have Beaumont-Hamel, you have Pietfall, which we'll look at a little bit more, all the way down, about 45 kilometres in length. That's a map that, as an officer in the Army, I would be familiar with, because it indicates the different corps. So three X's represents a corps. A corps will have, I'll show you this in a moment, will have at least three divisions. So two X's are a division. In modern terms, same as then, the unit of use is the division, because of its size and its ability to exercise military art. So in the First World War, a division was somewhere between 12 and 18,000 men strong. So with a 36th Ulster Division, you're talking about 12 infantry battalions augmented with different components. Its artillery actually was English. So the infantry battalions were drawn from Ireland, mostly Ulster, but the artillery was drawn mostly from the English. And that's the area that we're going to focus on briefly this evening. That's the order of battle, as it were. And the reason why I wanted to put that up is that although the Battle of the Somme is deeply ingrained within the cultural heritage and psyche of Ulster, actually the 36th Division was one of a large number of divisions that fought at the Somme. Now it's hugely reasonable for us to focus on the division that makes that has close resonance to us. So the 4th Army was commanded by General Rawlinson, who's a 4-star, and then you get corps commanders. So the 36th Ulster Division is under 10 corps, made up of 12 Div, 25 Div, 29 Div, 36th Div, and 32nd Division. Like most of the divisional setups still today, you will get a corps will have three divisions. Each division will have a minimum of three brigades. And so the three brigades within the 36th Ulster Division is 107, 108, and 109. 108 and 109 are on the front line. 107 is in reserve. I created this map for PowerPoint because I couldn't find an adequate one on the internet. It's taken from Philip Orr's book, On the Road to the Somme. And so the key thing I want you to focus on here is that the area of responsibility of the division is not actually enormous. And for those of you who have walked the Somme, you're not talking about vast distances here. So it's an amazing concentration. So you have 109 Brigade here. You have the sunken road that runs here. But their area of responsibility is here. And the interfee is with the 32nd Division, the Grimsby Pals, famously. And then on this side, you have elements of the 108th Brigade who would have actually stretched over here. And they attack on the left side of the River Ancre. Okay? Now, this is very famous, and the Schwaben Redoubt. That's what the map would look like if you overlay it with the actual outlay of the German trench systems. So this is Thiepval Wood. This is the area of interface. So Thiepval Village will be over here. And that's what the Schwaben Redoubt would have looked like if you were looking at it from the Ulster position. When I thought about the Schwaben Redoubt, I imagined some kind of giant edifice. It's not. It's a deeply interrelated series of trenches and machine gun posts. I mean, if you're going to attack something, this is not what you would attack. You wouldn't voluntarily want to attack something like this. And so the arrows represent the line of attack. What I've always was brought up with was the idea that one of the reasons why the Ulster Division was so successful is that they disobeyed orders and snuck out into no man's land. They didn't disobey orders. Nugent actually got them to move forward. This is long before the creeping barrage was perfected by the British Army. The battalions in the 109th Brigade were amazingly successful. They moved forward. There's a sunken road here. They moved forward and actually took the first German trench with relatively little casualties. The bombardment that was actually targeted on the German areas here was remarkably successful. It wasn't universally successful down the entire length of the British area of responsibility. It was more successful in the French area. And the primary difference was that the French had a greater number of concentration of artillery pieces. The other problem is that the munitions that were used by the British were not uniformly the same. And so an airburst shrapnel round will not damage barbed wire the same as the direct impact of a high-intensity warhead. So initially, the attack by the 36th Division is remarkably successful. And they capture the Schwaben Redoubt. But this area is not captured. This area is not captured. Now, we'll look at this side of the river in a moment. A decision is taken midway through the day that changes the situation for the Ulsterman in this. The corps commander, Thomas Moreland, was asked by the divisional commander to commit the corps reserves to consolidate the success that the Ulstermen had in the Schwaben Redoubt. So the idea was that the corps reserve, which would have been a division, and this is Nugent's plan, would have attacked, reinforced the Ulstermen, and came straight through, and then swept round and taken Thiepval from behind. That would have probably worked, because the Germans had not got sufficient numbers to reinforce this area. They were utterly and completely caught out by this. And actually, the number of troops in this area holding this was not huge. So if Moreland had have committed the corps reserve, a division, it could have been one of the great successes of the Second World War, the First World War. He didn't. Instead, what he chose to do was to go with the plan and committed the reserve into the attack on Thiepval Village, which was a complete failure. Now, the images that we have of the First World War are very specific. So, the area of attack of the 36th on the left-hand side of the River Ancre is actually in quite a narrow ravine type area. This is quite marshy. There's a battalion that attacks the mill here. But the next, and this is only me trying to give you a visual aid to try to understand it. When you imagine that that is an arc of fire of a machine gun, the Newfoundlanders, who distinguished themselves at Gallipoli, get absolutely slaughtered and annihilated. They don't make it more than maybe about 50 or 60 yards, and they suffer 90% casualties. 90% casualties, which is a ghastly number. And so, when you read some of the personal accounts of the soldiers who fought on this side of the river, the machine gun fire was so intense that it was almost like a mist of rain. But it wasn't a mist of rain. It was just that high level intensity of rounds. Which means that despite the valiant attack of the Newfoundlanders and the Ulstermen on this side, they didn't really get into the German lines and were pushed back. Now, generally speaking, when a presentation is given in the First World War, that's where the talk stopped, how pathetic the generals were. But interestingly, Diepwald was taken 2 months later, and the tactics they used sees the British troops moving forward as the artillery barrage creeps forward. So they learned from the experience of the Ulstermen on the first day of the Somme. The other thing that's notable in relation to the Battle of the Somme is that it's the first time that tanks are used in battle. And so the presence of just two tanks in the attack on Diepwald in September was enough to take out the machine guns that the artillery didn't get. And so they captured it relatively quickly. The other big difference is that by this stage, the commanders on the ground had insisted that they could go forward. The fog of war is well known, and anybody who's been in battle will understand that information can be really sketchy. When the Americans were in Vietnam, they had one of the most sophisticated networks for gathering information. The problem was, how do you process the information? And so when you skip forward 65 years from the Somme, the Americans, with their uber sophisticated series of communication networks, couldn't deal with the information. And so part of the problem was, how do you control the situation on the ground? So in September, whenever the attack goes in on Diepwald, the CO who actually is responsible for capturing it actually locates his headquarters in the centre of the village or the town, so that he is closer to the action. So the British have learned, and the tactics have developed. These are the tactics that the British would then develop and specialise in, that would actually become overwhelming and lead to ultimate success on the battlefield. There are three memorials in the immediate vicinity of the area of responsibility that the 36th had. You will know from history that the division is withdrawn on the 2nd of July, having sustained approximately 5,000 casualties. So if you think of the division is approximately 18,000, and that you're probably talking about 13,000 to 15,000 infantry soldiers going forward, that's one in three are killed or injured. So the division has ceased to be effective and is withdrawn and is replaced. And so the memorial to the missing is really at the interface between the two divisional lines. The Ulster Tower is just to the side of the Sunken Road, and then the Newfoundland Memorial Park is just to the south of Beaumont Hamel, where they were absolutely decimated. That's the Ulster Tower when it's first created, and you can see, even from this old black and white photograph, evidence of the aftermath of the war. But when you look at it today, it has been fundamentally transformed. And so when you visit some of the battlefields of the First World War, it's sometimes difficult to imagine the level of carnage and desolation that young men from around this area and wider afield in Ulster had to face. It's difficult to imagine how something like that could have been so monstrous. That is the memorial to the missing, which is, I find, as a serving soldier, I find this all very emotional, because my brigade lost 83 soldiers during our tour. And, you know, it's we'll talk about memorials in a moment, but it's striking. And that is the memorial to the Newfoundlanders. Four Victoria Crosses were won by members of the 36th Ulster Division on the first day of the Somme. Those, what you'll see, are extracts from the citation. Incredibly, incredibly courageous. Lieutenant Geoffrey Sir George Shillington Charter, VC, was actually the son of a Church of Ireland minister. Killed in action. Perhaps the most tragic is this young man, 14th Battalion, the Royal Irish Rifles. This is a bit of an indicator that this is one of Kitchener's battalions because of the number. Bombardier, an accident happens, and there's some bombs that go live. And without a second's hesitation, he falls on the bombs to protect his people and is killed instantly. And Private Robert Quigg, who became Sergeant Quigg from Bush Mills, is the fourth VC winner. You'll find that many of the citations for Victoria Crosses are all in relation to heroic actions recovering the injured. Only one of the four was heroic action in an attack on the enemy. The others are either in defence of their colleagues, like McFadden, who throws himself on the bomb, or they go looking for the injured. Battle of the Somme, in what sense can we say it was for Ulster? And now we get into more choppy waters, I think. Citizens, not consumers. One of the key arguments I want to make tonight is that the world that we're thinking about is radically different to the one that we inhabit. In fact, I'm going to make the point at the end of the lecture that those who supported the 36th Division, those who fought in the 36th Ulster Division, are closer in spirit to those who signed the Declaration of Independence in America in 1784 than we are to them, despite the fact that it was 100 years ago, because of the profound change that has taken place in our society. The advances in medicine, healthcare, and social care are things to be celebrated. The advances in our society, I think, are great. Those changes are a direct result of the First World War and then the Second World War. We'll look a little bit in a little moment at a concept that may be new to some, but the concept of state has not been monolithic. It has been evolving and changing. And the changes in the state and how the state interacts with citizens has been in a process of evolution, and that evolution has been influenced by the sacrifice in the First World War and in the Second World War. When I was doing some doctoral work a few years ago, I was shocked by this. The average life expectancy of someone born in 1900, if you were a man, was 34. Now think about that when we imagine the raising of the divisions. There are three British armies in the First World War. People just think of the British Army. There are three distinct groupings. The first group, the professional army, which the Kaiser labelled that contemptible little army because it was a small, about 128,000 regular soldiers. And then you have Kitchener's army that is raised and trained between 14 and 16 that goes into action for the first time on the 1st of July in 1916. And then the third army is the conscript army. But when you think of the volunteer army, when you think of Kitchener's army and the tens of thousands of people that joined up, they did so in an age in which life expectancy, if you were a man, was 34. I find it striking that from Ireland, three divisions were raised. The 10th, which was the first Irish division to go into action and distinguish itself at Gallipoli, and then the 36th Ulster Division, and the 16th Irish Division, that was largely raised from the Redford's Volunteers. I think that this is significant in understanding and trying to put ourselves into the mindset of those who volunteered to fight in the First World War. A scholar called Philip Bobbitt talks about different stages of the state. Now, the state goes through different iterations. So when I talk about citizens, not consumers, I'm thinking about the market state. When you listen to politicians talk today, and I'm no desire to be political, one of the key things they talk about is choice. Giving people choice. And that represents the market state. Because that's what the market's about. It's about state. So you have the territorial state, and so you get some of the wars are fought in the early 19th century in relation to territorial integrity. But then you get into the state-nation, and that's the one that's going to flash, because this is the point where nations begin to forge identity. And I'm going to try to show you that through the imagery from the memorials. And then you get the nation-state, where the emphasis on the state is welfare. So the welfare reform that transformed society is a result of the sacrifice that people made in the First World War and the Second World War. People came back from the First World War demanding that the state change and provide social support that wasn't acceptable to continue as it was. It doesn't happen for a variety of reasons, but after the Second World War, the country dumps Churchill like that, because what he offered is not what they wanted. They wanted the state to look after the welfare of its citizens. But this is the area that we need to focus on. And if you want to understand the men who fought in the 36th Ulster Division, you have to understand this. It's about forging identities and identities of nation. You can see this in the memorials that nation states have made. Particularly, we're going to focus on Dominion nations. So that's the memorial to South Africa. That's the Australian memorial. But the one that really emphasizes this, and when you see this, what I want you to imagine is that this is a declaration by a nation as to it has come into existence. It's not simply a dominion of the empire. You cannot visit Vimy Ridge and not be struck that Canada is saying something to the world. Canada is an independent, sovereign nation. And this is an image that we will see again used in Ulster much earlier. And this is sometimes referred to by some as Mother Canada, weeping for her dead. Now, I don't know if you visited Vimy Ridge, but it is one of the most impressive things you can see. On a sunny day, as you approach it, it's almost blinding to see. And I didn't understand the first time I saw it because I was struggling. Why would the Canadians do this? They did it because it was an integral part of the forging of the identity of Canada. You can't understand Australia, for example, unless you understand Gallipoli. When you stand at Sulva Bay, where they landed, and you see the cliff faces in front of them, it's almost impossible to imagine that the Australians fought their way up there. They dug into the side and tenaciously fought on. So the whole character of Australia, to some extent, is forged in war and is forged at Gallipoli. And that is the context in which I think you should understand the Ulster Tower. Now, I know that in academic circles, this is hugely contentious ground. But this is about identity forging. It's not simply a memorial to soldiers who fought, because this memorial isn't in Ulster, this memorial is on the battlefield. It would have been very difficult for people from Northern Ireland to visit this. This is about identity. This is about forging the identity of a new nation. And of course, the story of the 36th Division is interrelated with this. The signing of the Ulster Covenant, the 28th of September 1912, also called Ulster Day. Ulster's Solemn League and Covenant. I wonder how many have actually taken the time to read it. It is stirring stuff. I won't take the time to read it. We will look at extracts in the next section, but it's stirring stuff. But I wonder, do you know on which it's based? That's it. That is it. It's not just a rhetorical question. Any idea on what it's based?
The American War?
No, something that predates it, but they're all interrelated. The Scottish Covenant. See, and I sometimes say this in presentations, in England, we owe a tremendous debt to the Covenanters. They're not perfect. I know some would like to think them as perfect. They're not perfect. But actually, what this represents is the idea that it's not the state to tell its citizens what to believe, how to practice, where to worship. It's not the state's business. And I think you can see a direct correlation between this and then one of the more famous documents that's written about 70 years later, actually less, the Declaration of Independence in America. So the Ulster Covenant comes in a line of really important documents. And then the imagery of the period is really emotive. And so you have, we saw the depiction of what some people call Mother Canada. Here you have the representation of Ulster as a female, but she's armed, forlorn, needing to be defended. Some of the imagery of the period, and you can accuse me for being very selective, and you do have to select, you just can't show everything, otherwise you would need breakfast in the morning. But this is a fundamental question. Sometimes, because people don't understand their history, they don't understand that the Irish question was a question that affected everybody in the United Kingdom. And so there's this idea that Ulster was forced to stand alone. And so you have the creation of the UDF. But Cyril Falls, in his book, written just a few years after the end of the First World War, gives one of the reasons why it was a formed body. It was to control the use of force so that it wouldn't devolve into a kind of fractious civil war. And so they designed the UDF to resemble a regular formation. And when you see the uniform, you see the way they're dressed, you see the way they're equipped by German rifles. What you see here is the origin of the 36th Ulster Division. So they go from that to the very famous painting of the division going over the top on the 1st of July. Now, at the heart of this is a concept called social contract theory. Now, one of the things that I spend a lot of my time doing is explaining to people their own history and the concepts that underpin our way of life. Our way of life is based on this idea of a social contract theory. It lies at the very heart of Western liberal democracy. So the election, for all its flaws in America, is about social contract theory. What is the type of country that we want to live in? What type of society do we want to live in? How do we negotiate the type of contract that we as citizens are prepared to accept? But here we get into waters that are not familiar in the way that it would have been familiar to those in 1912. And that is duties and obligations of every citizen. This is an extract taken from John Stuart Mill's book on liberty. And I'm going to read it because it's really powerful. Because the people who supported the Ulster Covenant, the people who supported the creation of the UDF, the people who supported the rising of the 36th Division, which was generally funded not by the state, but by private donors and by most of the ambulances were provided by the people of Ulster. There are also many positive acts for the benefit of others which he may be rightfully compelled to perform, such as to give evidence in a court of justice, to bear his fair share in common defence, or any joint work necessary to the interest of society in which he enjoys protection. They lived in an age in which a fundamental tenet of their entire belief system was that as citizens they had a duty, an obligation to the society that they were part of. I don't believe that that same concept exists today. And of course, this is heavily influenced by Reformed theology. I find it amusing sometimes where my Reformed brethren don't recognize the influence of Reformed theology in the creation of the individual that we see today in society. The individual didn't emerge in a vacuum. He emerged in a context in which there was a philosophy and a theology from which he emerges. So when, and next year is it the 500th anniversary of Luther kneeling. When Luther articulated justification by faith alone, what he was doing was introducing an idea that would lay the basis for modern democracy. That's not what he was doing when he was kneeling the thesis, but that's an implication of it. Because a man's relationship with God was not dependent on his family, or his neighbourhood, or his town, or his tribe, or a church. A person had to stand alone before God and give an account alone before God. And for the first time in the pages of literature, you get a character that emerges that doesn't exist in ancient Greek: the individual. The concept of the individual is largely related to Reformed theology. The call to arms in 1914 must be set in the context of what was considered to be the reasonable duty and obligation of the citizen. For the people of Ulster and Ireland, it offered a very specific lens through which the very idea of citizenship could be viewed. So those who had joined Redford's Volunteers, who then decided to fight for the British, were hoping for exactly the same thing as the men who joined the 36th Ulster Division, that the display of citizenship would influence how England would view their particular cause. What may seem remarkably strange because of the age in which we live, of the narcissistic hedonist, the me, is that one of the fundamental principles that would have motivated many who joined the 36th Division is this idea that they responded as citizens in relation to their duty as citizens. Now you see it in this poem, which was hugely popular in its day. What of the men of Ulster, hark to the arm tread, as they turn their back on the province and face to the front instead? Look at the next sentence. The sword half drawn on her own behalf. It's striking that. No one was left in any illusion as to the political context. And Ulster's red right hand will leap from the scabbard and flash like fire for the common motherland. And wherever the fight is hottest and the sorest task is set, Ulster will strike for England, and England will not forget. So those men who went off to France and the families who were behind would likely have been very familiar with this poem. And this is the framework through which you should understand the motivation through which those who supported the division and those who fought for the division understood their relationship at that time. At the beginning of the 20th century, people saw themselves as citizens. The phrase for Ulster is not rhetoric, but was, I would want to contend, a deeply held conviction for the people who supported the division and those who joined the division. Towards the end of the 20th century, we see the rise of the citizen consumer, and academics will openly talk about the rise of the emphasis of the consumer. I want to suggest today that The emphasis for many people is on the consumer, their rights, as opposed to what was the driving feature at the beginning of the century, the obligations of the city, or the citizen. What are the obligations and the duty of the citizen? The citizen, duties and obligations to society, the consumer, of course. And so you see the transformation in our understanding of the state. So the state creating identity, to the state, the purpose of the market state today in enabling choice. So what about for God? Well, I call this section Covenant and Hope. And we're back to Ulster's Solemn League and Covenant. What I want you to note in the next extract is the relationship between religious freedom and citizenship. Being convinced in our consciousness that home rule would be disastrous to the material well-being of Ulster, as well as of the whole of Ireland, subversive of our civil and religious freedom, destructive of our citizenship. Hundreds of thousands of people signed this. Many signed it in blood. And that's not just a myth. There is a direct relationship between the understanding of civil freedoms and religious freedoms. Direct relationship. Religious freedom and liberty was understood as being fundamentally related to an understanding of citizenship. And so you can see echoes of the Scottish Covenant in the early 17th century. It's not for the state to dictate what we believe, how we practice our belief, how we meet together to express religious worship. That should be the freedom of citizens to choose how they do that. Now, I'm a Baptist, and so I'm a nonconformist. And one of the things that I hold particularly dear as a Baptist is that it's none of government's business to tell me how to practice my faith and what to believe and how to exercise my faith, which is why I fundamentally reject the new atheist agenda. And sometimes I'm asked to publicly resist some of the arguments that they make. And the basis on what I wrote, an article that's in the British Army Review, and it's called In Defense of Liberty, and I went back to this principle. It's no one's right to tell me where to practice my faith. No one's right. Another extract from the Covenant. Humbly relying on the God whom our fathers in days of stress and trial confidently trusted to hereby pledge ourselves in solemn covenant. If you can't see theology in that, then my lecture will be meaningless. Those who signed this covenant were deeply convinced that they were being consistent with earlier generations whose faith was now cited as a convincing example. One of the strengths of the covenant, what Carson had in mind, was that unlike the Scottish covenant, which is enormous, the Ulster covenant could be folded and put in your wallet so people could carry it with them. You know, Jefferson did something similar when he created the Declaration of Independence. It was absolutely essential in trying to motivate the Americans to resist the British that it was located within their Christian faith. Which is why, in that wonderful passage, he talks about the inalienable natural rights that we possess because we're made in the image of God. Now, in an increasingly secular age, this use of language and public confession of Christian faith may actually seem disconcerting or striking. But it wasn't to those who signed it. Now, the emphasis I want to change now, and one of the big differences between the beginning forgive me, of the 20th century and the end of the 20th century, is that those who signed the covenant, those who joined up, had a theology of death that does not exist in the 21st century for many people who have no contact with Christianity. And so Richard Holmes says, regardless of the century or the historical snapshot of human involvement in warfare chosen, death and wounds are inescapable part of battle. It didn't come as a complete shock, because the Ulster Division had been in the lines from about Christmas 15. News from the front had come in. Everybody knew how bad the war was. People would have been aware of the carnage at Verdun. They weren't caught out. They were merely caught out by the level of casualties. They were convinced that the artillery bombardment that would annihilate the Germans and no one could survive. But they weren't unaware of the dangers of First World War trench warfare in the First World War. Now, this is something, when I first read it, I had to spend time. He was my external examiner, Christopher Coker. And he notes that death was once the overriding theme of literature. Death and battle had meaning in such a world. In our world, it doesn't. Now, one of the things that frustrated me as a chaplain, having served in Afghanistan, is this modern notion that death is meaningless. Well, death is only meaningless if you take it out of a context in which death can have meaning. One of the biggest differences, as I said, is that the men who signed up and the families who supported it would have had a theology of death that would have given them a hope that would have transcended death. Today, the new atheists want us to imagine that we're living in a world that is ultimately pointless and meaningless and purposeless. That your life is utterly meaningless because we're an insignificant speck in a process that's ongoing and eventually will run out of steam and die of atrophy. That's the image. So therefore, what meaning can there be if there is no purpose in a meaningless Big Bang that's just moving through space until it runs out of power and everything dies? But those who supported the creation of the division and those who signed up to fight did not live in that world. They had a theology that offered hope. And this is an extract from Philip Orr's book. I remember one Sunday evening we were holding an open-air service behind the wood. That would have been Deepfall. In the middle of the service, the birds around us started to sing, and the preacher told us to be quiet and listen. All we could hear was the birds singing. After a while, he said that the birds had praised their Maker better than he could and asked us to repeat the Lord's Prayer, and we went back to the trenches. What I'm trying to tell you is that you can get close to God anywhere and anytime. Some of us in the 36th live close to death and God at the same time. There were regular chaplains drawn from mostly the Presbyterian Church and the Church of Ireland. But what was not entirely unique, but what was a distinguishing feature of the 36th Division is the number of preachers that actually were embedded within the division. Just ordinary people, local preachers, people who would have spoken in the mission halls. So there were a multitude of meetings that would have taken place, meetings that were held by the chaplains and meetings that would have been held by local preachers. Do you know one of the hymns that Philip Orr identifies as one of the popular hymns sung? And this brought a lump to my throat genuinely when I discovered this. Then the trumpet of the Lord shall sound, and time shall be no more, and the morning breaks eternal, bright and fair, when the sea at the verse shall gather over on the other shore, and the roll is called up yonder, I'll be there. I mean, the men who were in the trenches understood that they faced death. They faced intermittent shelling, and death was always a present reality. And having been in a war environment, war is ever present, especially when you're losing large numbers of people and people are being killed. You can't ignore death. You're forced to confront death. What I want to suggest to you is that the men in the trenches, or the vast majority of them, not only were they confronted by death, but they were also confronted by those who offered a theology of hope, the hope of the Christian gospel. The Christian faith of many of the men of the 36th Ulster Division was one of their distinctive marks. They're frequently referred to as the Calvinists from Ulster. They actually had cultural sensitivity instruction. Did you know that? There was a genuine attempt to explain to the Ulstermen, and if you go to modern day France, you will still see this, or Belgium, that they will find lots of crucifixes dotted all over France, and not to be offended because it was part of the French way of life. I find that amazing, that there was a necessity to give that level of instruction. Because almost all of the histories record the Christian faith of the division. The hope of the Christian gospel was a source of profound comfort to those facing the prospect of death. There's an old saying, and I think there's a degree of truth in it, that there are no atheists in a foxhole, because it does require a tremendous amount of faith to think that it's just index and there's nothing. And so in conclusion, and what time is it? Have I kept broadly to the time? Oh, sorry. I was aiming at 45 minutes in the hope that it would take an hour. In terms of trying to understand the mindset of those who supported the creation of the division and the men who signed up to fight and fought so magnificently on the first day of the Somme, they are closer in spirit to those who signed the American Declaration of Independence in 1784 than we are to them. Because the same concepts of duty and obligation of citizen underpin what happened in the American War of Revolution. The phrase "for God and Ulster" is not political rhetoric. I want to contend that is actually drawn from deeply held beliefs. I don't think it's possible to read the Ulster Covenant and not be struck that this was appealing to deeply held Christian beliefs. It was a profound understanding of the duties of the citizen that underpinned by the hope that the Christian gospel gives, that provides the framework through which we should view the men who fought from the 36th Ulster Division on the first day of the Somme. The motto "for God and Ulster," when set in the context I sought to present, is not rhetoric. There's substance that underpins it. And I think it's a substance that many today would have difficulty in really understanding, because we live in a consumerist age.